From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A 6,000-acre wildfire threatens homes in Collier County. Its billowing smoke cloud has forced the closure of numerous roads, including the major artery through the region, I-75. We will have the latest news on that fire from Collier County this hour. Plus, we'll talk with the American Red Cross about efforts to help people displaced by evacuations. A local meteorologist will be in the studio to talk about how weather conditions created a perfect storm for this fire and what the forecast holds. We'll also find out from medical professionals what all this smoke does to healthy lungs and the stress it causes for people who already have breathing problems. Plus, the Florida Conference of Historians will host its 57th annual meeting in Punta Gorda this weekend. It's an event at which faculty, students, and independent historians present proposals of historic inquiry on subjects ranging from media and arts to the history of Florida. The winning papers are then published in the FCH's nationally recognized journal. We'll talk with some of the historians who will be there about keeping the past alive. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A wildfire in Collier County has captured national attention and forced evacuations from homes. The giant smoke cloud was visible as far north as Sanibel as the number of burning acres topped 6,500. For the very latest on this fire, we turn to Kate Ebbers, who joins us by phone. She's the public information coordinator for Collier County. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So what is happening right now?
Well, right now they are working to contain the fire, which has reached 7,500 acres about, and we have about 30% containment.
Are roads still closed as a result of this?
Interstate 75 is still closed from mile marker 80, which is State Road 29, to mile marker 105, which is Golden Gate Parkway, and we're expecting that to be closed for most of the day. County Road 951, Collier Boulevard, has reopened. It was closed yesterday between Golden Gate Parkway and Rattlesnake Hammock Road, but we caution people that there could be intermittent closures throughout the day, and just to pay attention to local media reports and follow the county on our social media accounts, Facebook and Twitter, for the latest updates.
And we have links to those on our WGCUnews.org, so people can go there and check those out and find those links to get there. I wanted to ask also, are there still evacuation efforts going on?
There are no more evacuation efforts going on now. Currently, Club Naples RV Park, Panther Walk RV Park, and the horse stables in the Picayune Strand State Forest are under a mandatory evacuation, and people and animals that live there have not been allowed to return.
Okay, so
the Forest Glen evacuation, which happened yesterday, was lifted late last night.
So they were able to go back home. Was there any damage?
They were able to go back home. As far as we know, there was no damage. There have been two homes and about three pole barns that have been lost in the fire. One of the homes was occupied. One of the homes was not occupied.
Okay, and then I wanted to also ask, you said that it grew from 6,500 to 7,500. Is that growing away from populated areas?
Yes.
Okay, so the immediate danger isn't increased because of that increased number.
That's correct. But we're still trying, we're still trying to hold the fire at the Collier Boulevard and at Interstate 75 to make sure it doesn't go north and it doesn't come west.
Or jump the interstate.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you. I want to tell you that I appreciate your time talking with us, and we're going to have a lot more on this fire later in the show with a local meteorologist, the head of the local Red Cross, and a Lee County firefighter about the brush fire they just handled a little further north in Lehigh. Plus, we'll be checking back in with you, Kate Ebbers, for the latest from Collier County later in the show. But first, a group of historians are meeting at Punta Gorda this weekend, sharing their work about the past in the 57th Annual State Conference of Historians. They're tackling everything from local history to pop culture to the declining number of history classes required for students in Florida schools. Hosting this year's event is President-elect of the Florida Conference of Historians, is Dr. Thomas Donaldson, who's a history professor with Florida Southwestern State College in Charlotte County. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
Attending the conference this year, we have two FGCU history professors, Dr. Nicola Foote, the chair of the FGCU Department of Social Sciences. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Michael Cole, who is an assistant professor of history. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also on the line from Jacksonville University, we have conference organizer Dr. Jesse Hingston. Welcome to the show via phone.
Thank you for having me.
We are talking about Florida history and the upcoming Conference of Florida Historians coming to Punta Gorda this weekend. What questions do you have about history in our region, or about the country, or about the world, or about being a professional historian yourself? Share your thoughts with us at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Dr. Jesse Hingston, you've been organizing the conference this year from afar. Tell us about what people can expect at this year's conference.
Well, thank you for having us on the program. We have so many things planned this weekend. It's a three-day conference at the Charlotte Harbor Event and Conference Center in Punta Gorda. On Friday, we have a roundtable that we're going to be having at Hurricane Charlie's right next to the Punta Gorda Waterfront Hotel. There, we're going to be featuring a discussion on the decline in the number of history classes required to graduate from Florida's colleges and universities. Our main day, our main event will be on Saturday. We're going to hold a series of panels. We're also going to be featuring a keynote address by Dr. Murrow McLeod. We'll also have the banquet. And on Sunday morning, we're going to be having two tours, both beginning at 8:30, one that focuses on the Indian Spring Cemetery Living History Tour, and the other one is a walking tour sponsored by the Punta Gorda Historic Mural Society.
Now, a lot of these presentations are open to the public. Are there any particular presentations that you think would be interesting to the general public and regular Joes in Southwest Florida?
Absolutely. One thing about the Florida Conference of Historians is that we cover all aspects of history. So we're talking about African-American history, women's history, especially in the spirit of Women's History Month. We are featuring Florida history especially. We have also a variety of ways that we're presenting. We have a poster session featuring students presenting their work. We also have two film screenings. One of the films is one that we're really interested to look at. It's called Marching Forward, and it's about two high schools, segregated high schools, in Orlando that they were invited to perform at the 1964 World's Fair in New York City. And what is interesting is that despite the racial segregation, they came together through music. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really inspiring story that we're really looking forward to screening. And also Latin American history, Asian history. We have so many people coming from all over the world, in fact.
Yeah, we have people that are actually so interested in history. I haven't even had a chance to introduce our other guests, and we already have a caller on the line. So I'm going to just go ahead and throw this one out there and see who wants to pick it up. This is Jack from Fort Myers, and he has a question for our historians. Jack, what would you like to ask?
Yes, my question is actually about the history before the United States started to come down to South Florida, and well, Florida in general. But my question is, how much is known about the Native American history or the history before kind of we got here? I was just curious to know how much is known, and I'll take my answer off the air.
And that sounds like a perfect question for Dr. Michael Cole. You teach U.S. and Latin American history, and you've also taught a course about the conquest and colonization of Mexico. So what would you say to answer that question?
Well, yes, it is interesting that actually a great deal is known about the history of Florida before it became a U.S. territory. And I'm not sure why. Perhaps it doesn't get covered in school as much as it might. But Florida, in fact, was a colony of Spain for a longer period of time than it's been a part of the United States. And in fact, I believe last weekend there was a symposium at Florida Southwestern. There were a number of archaeologists and historians who specialize in early Florida history.
So pre-colonialization, what was happening here?
You mean before Europeans arrived?
Yes.
Well, that's a little bit more difficult. That's more primarily based on archaeology. And so you know, we have some material evidence, artifacts that are found in local digs. And that was one of the things that was being covered at this symposium that unfortunately I wasn't able to attend. I believe it was this past weekend, and there were a number of prominent scholars, Jerry Milanich and Michael, I'm sorry, the name escapes me now.
Yeah, but what's interesting is what you mentioned in the very beginning, which is another part of this that I wanted to direct to Thomas Donaldson with FWS, is the part about there not being that many history courses that are required of students that are coming out of college.
Yeah, the state has been trying to cut back on the number of courses that students are required to take in general, and also in history and the social sciences in particular. Part of the logic is to keep the students focused on their professional studies, to get their degree in their field of specialty. And another issue is affordability. Each class is, you know, a certain part of their tuition. So that's the logic that has been putting pressure on the system. And it makes it more difficult for us because we're getting students who don't have as much of a background in the discipline as they might have. So
it's kind of shaping the well-rounded student.
Right.
And is that kind of part of the focus of having conferences like this, to get history out in front of people so people can, you know, maybe find it a bit more attractive that they want to go out of the way to take the classes even though they're not, you know, required to do so?
I think that's certainly a desire of the Florida Conference of Historians, that we're really trying to be an inviting organization and bring academic history into out of the ivory tower and in more into the popular eye. What a lot of the studies are in the Florida Conference of Historians annual meeting is very interesting studies on very down to earth issues, and it's not what a lot of people think about in terms of academic history.
It's not boring and dusty, is what you're telling me.
Right. It's not a lot of names and dates. It's about people living their lives, regular people. It's not just the leadership and the wars and laws and Supreme Court cases.
And they can apply to modern events and what's happening day to day. And in the course of our introductions, I didn't get a chance to introduce Nicola Foote, and you're a professor of Latin American history and the chair of FGCU's Department of Social Sciences. And you are talking a lot about race and migration in your studies. Can you tell me a little bit about how understanding that in the past can have an impact on understanding what's happening today?
Absolutely. So the work that I'm presenting at the conference on Saturday deals with migration from the Caribbean, from islands like Barbados, Jamaica, Trinidad, to Latin America. But these migrants were going to work for U.S. companies on the coast of Central America and Panama and Costa Rica.
And what time period are we talking about?
This is the early 20th century. So it's the period when the Panama Canal is being constructed, when Chiquita Banana Company was founded as the United Fruit Company. So there's enormous U.S. investment, and they needed workers that could speak English. So this was why they were hiring West Indian migrants. But there was enormous controversy in Latin America about the importation of those migrants that was heavily racialized often, but was also framed in many of the same ways in which you hear debates about immigration today, concerns about workers taking jobs, concerns about cultural assimilation, that these were workers from a very different cultural background who spoke English, who were Protestant, not Catholic, and who were black. That was an issue for many of the Latin American governments of the time. So my broader work looks at some of the hostility that those immigrants faced and the sort of ways in which they navigated those challenges. And something that is very notable is that often their children were left without citizenship because the British government at the time, the West Indian Islands were British territories. They were part of the British Empire. And the British government didn't recognize the children of West Indians born in Latin America as British subjects, but the Latin American governments wouldn't accept them either. So you had tens of thousands of stateless people who, you know, had no formal identity documents, no passports. And, you know, this is a human tragedy when something like that happens. They get trapped without options.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how everything old is new again, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you guys do the biggest eye roll when people say, well, you learn history so you don't repeat it. And you're probably looking at it like it repeats itself all the time, like over and over and over again. So I wanted to ask Dr. Michael Cole about what you're studying. And I heard that you've been translating documents, letters that were written back to Spain. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, I'm working on a book right now, a translation of some of the letters that Hernan Cortes wrote to the King of Spain during the conquest of Mexico.
So what did he write about?
Well, actually, his expedition was illegal. It didn't have a license to go on and conquer and colonize. You needed a license from the crown in order to do so. And so he wrote these letters as a justification of his actions to try to convince the King of Spain that he shouldn't be arrested and tried for treason, for treasonous actions, and to convince the King of Spain that he was bringing great wealth and an enormous number of new subjects into the Spanish realms.
And what did he actually bring?
Well, in fact, he succeeded at that. He both succeeded in the conquest of the Aztecs, and he succeeded in convincing the King of Spain to sort of forgive his transgressions.
So he might have been a part-time attorney working on his own behalf.
In fact, early on in his life, he was sent to Salamanca to study grammar in preparation for a law career. And as it turned out, he wasn't interested in studies as much as he was expected. And so he boarded a ship for the New World and, you know, tried to seek his fortune
there. Something
must
have stuck in because he was able to write his way out of being convicted for illegal conquest.
He did have a lot of basic legal training. He worked for many years in the Caribbean as a bureaucrat in the Spanish colonial government before striking out for Mexico in 1519. And so he had a basic understanding of Spanish imperial law and very sort of keen idea about how to manipulate people. And that's what those letters are about, manipulating people's ideas about what he was doing. He had a lot of enemies in the Spanish Caribbean who wanted to see him stopped during the middle of the conquest and arrested for treason, essentially.
That's got to be an interesting insight into the mind of a really famous person just translating these letters.
Well, it's interesting to me,
it's
for sure.
It's clearly interesting enough to you.
And I'm hoping that the book will appeal to college courses and will be adopted for that. And that part of when the publisher approached me and asked me to do this book, that was one of the things that they told me they were looking for was something that would have a more a general appeal.
Mm-hmm. And Thomas Donaldson with FWS, speaking of
FSW.
FSW. I have it written down here wrong. I'm sorry. One part it's written. Okay. Sorry. But I wanted to ask you, speaking of things that are interesting and not interesting, and you were mentioning earlier that history is not just old dusty dames and stuff, you've written papers and even several books about the phenomenon in comic books about gender politics and U.S. impact on pop culture, comic books from the 50s and 60s. How did that niche get – how did that arrive to you?
Well, I was a long-term comic book collector, superhero comic book fan, and in fact, in my undergraduate years, I entertained dreams of writing comic books, and my mother said to me at that point, it's like, that's nice, dear, but don't forget to get a real job. So this was my way of taking all that time and effort that she complained about during my adolescence, like, should be focusing on my studies and using it to my best advantage in getting a job. So there you go. And I gravitated to gender largely because of a couple of events that one of which took place before I was born, but one of which, or a couple of which took place while I was very young. During the early 1970s, there was a spate of television programs, most notably Wonder Woman, but Bionic Woman and Secrets of Isis, featuring female superheroes. And there was a parallel development in comic books. And that was an informative moment for me because I was very interested in superheroes as a child. And so those were some of the programs that I watched regularly. And then later on in my life, I would learn about an event in the 1950s where the comic book, like what happens in many pop culture arenas, is a move toward censorship in comic books. And the height of this movement was brought on by a report by a psychiatrist, Dr. Frederick Wertham, who made a link between juvenile delinquency, which was a big issue in the 1950s, and the growth of homosexuality or the promotion of homosexuality and comic book readership. So
they tried to link that?
Well, he did link that. Them in a book called Seduction of the Innocent, and in looking at it, the comic book industry, which was suffering from an economic downturn after the World War II, had to take these reports in mind. Otherwise, they were looking at possibility of government regulation of their industry, and so one of the they created a code of production code called the Comics Code Authority, and it mandated rules on how women were portrayed, and that really trying to institutionalize the Leave It to Beaver image of domestic womanhood.
So it kind of you're saying that they this guy had this like his book that he wrote, and then he tried to implement ways that women would then be kind of like a more misogynistic approach to comic books?
Yes, this coincided and aligned the movement with government investigations into juvenile delinquency.
So it's interesting because you're looking at something that seems so innocent and yeah, whatever, as a comic book, but it's actually a big political and a sexism and a whole lot of things going into that. So speaking to your point earlier about things that are interesting and definitely not dusty, but that is part of history, and it has some serious social ramifications.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things is that we don't write diaries as much as we used to. So one of the things that I believe is that our popular culture consumption, what is popular, what declines in popularity, is a way to gauge the thinking of the people in that to move it away from the elites.
It's definitely very powerful. That is powerful. And Dr. Jesse Hingston, I don't want to leave you hanging there on the line. Tell me a little bit more about how people can get involved in this conference. Can they just show up or do they need to register ahead of time?
Well, participants register and we have a pre-registration process that we've just concluded. When participants come to the meeting, we will have a registration table where they can pick up a program, a badge, and also their a copy of our journal that we publish. It's called the FCH Annals.
And that journal will feature the leading papers out of this conference in the next publication.
That's correct.
All right.
And so so we'll definitely have those, and then of course. The conference, the meeting is open, as you mentioned, to the public, and it is free. And we welcome any and all people to come and take a look at what we have to offer.
And we have a link to your website so people can browse that and figure out where to go, when to go, and how to get there. We are about out of time right now, but I want to thank you all for coming in today. We could talk for hours about all of this stuff. It's so interesting. But I want to thank you for coming in. Thomas Donaldson, Conference President, Dr. Nicola Foote from FGCU, and Dr. Michael S. Cole from FGCU. And thank you for joining us on the phone, Dr. Jesse Hingston from Jacksonville University. Coming up, we'll get the very latest from Collier County on the wildfire raging there, and we'll talk with a local meteorologist about the conditions that led to this fire and find out what the forecast looks like. We'll be right back.